Good morning, and welcome to another in our series on legal ethics. I want to give a special thank you to Yechiel Coleman, the Gene C. Coleman Family Law Center, for sponsoring breakfast this morning. This was entirely spontaneous. He approached me and said, "Well, I'd like to provide breakfast, so all of you can please thank Yechiel for his provision of this Mother's Day breakfast." And I want to thank the Bayit Brotherhood for their work in providing the food. Dan Valter with my Beit Midrash for his work in helping to set it up. There are sign-in sheets on all of the tables, or at least three of the tables. Please make sure that you sign in, especially if you want credit, but also if you'd like to be on the email list for follow-up from this class or for notification about future classes. The next class in the series is actually part of a program with B'nai B'rith. It will be on the morning of June 2nd at Shari Shamayim, and the subject is 100 questions about a will challenge. So that's the morning of, I think it's Tuesday, June 2nd. A couple of other thank yous before we start the material. One is to Jeffrey Silver, who I believe is here, for his help as my legal consultant. That does not create any liability or responsibility for him for anything I say. All mistakes are mine, but I'm grateful for his assistance. As well as a couple of shiurim which I heard, a couple of lectures which I heard, one from Rabbi Herschel Schefter of Yeshiva University, one from Rabbi Yonah Ries, who is now of the Chicago Rabbinical Council's Beit Din, and they provided a lot of helpful material in preparing this. Our topic for this morning is conflict of interest, the blindness of the bride's conflict of interest, and we have a lot to get through. If you have the source sheets there, there are source sheets on all of the tables, as well as some on a table in the back. You can see that we have a lot to go through on this, but what I want to do is begin by talking about the philosophy behind our concern for conflict of interest, what exactly it is that we are concerned about, and then we'll deal with three questions regarding a particular case that I've set out on your sheet. Number one, how do we define conflict of interest? Number two, let's say there is a conflict of interest. Is there anything a lawyer can do to be able to work for the client anyway? And then third, if it's determined that there is no conflict of interest, but there is an appearance of conflict, what is a lawyer's responsibility? And again, as always in this series, we're going to be comparing the Jewish law perspective with that of the Law Society of Upper Canada. So we begin by defining conflict of interest. If you take a look at the first source on your sheet, this is from the beginning of the Rules of Professional Conduct, the newest edition from 2014. In the beginning where they define terms, we are told, conflict of interest means the existence of a substantial risk that a lawyer's loyalty to or representation of a client would be materially and adversely affected by the lawyer's own interest or the lawyer's duties to another client, a former client, or a third person. Okay, so there is a risk, there is some kind of a risk that the lawyer is not going to be entirely loyal to the client, but instead is loyal to some other personal concern, or to another client, former client, outside party. The risk must be more than a mere possibility. There must be a genuine, serious risk to the duty of loyalty or to client representation arising from the retainer. And what we see here is that on the one hand, there is concern that the lawyer might not serve the client wholeheartedly, but on the other hand, we limit it and say only if it's a genuine, serious risk. And we'll discuss why we limit it and why we don't simply say any possibility will disqualify. But that's the Law Society's definition. And so lawyers have mechanisms, you all know about this, I am sure, to track and flag potential conflicts. I learned about all sorts of systems. I saw the CBA has a toolkit on their website, but lawyers have all sorts of systems to track and warn about potential conflicts. If you take a look at source number two, you find a comment from the Talmud which I think puts it a little bit more poetically than the Law Society's definition. There's a biblical verse which we're going to see later which warns against accepting what's called in Hebrew a shochad. Shochad means A bribe, right? Shochad means a bribe. So Amar Rava, in the Talmud in source number 2, Rava, one of the sages, he's speaking in the 3rd century, he says, "My time of the Shochada, why is it that a bribe is forbidden? Kevan de kabile shochda mine, once he accepts a bribe from somebody, ikra vale daite legabe, his mind becomes close to that person, vahave kigufe, and he becomes like him." Obviously, this interest that we're talking about is particularly an interest involving another party as opposed to one's personal interest. But the idea is that when somebody else offers you something, that draws you near to him and you become like him. Ve'ein adam roe chova le'atzmo, and you can't see guilt for yourself. Now here it's not talking about a lawyer, it's talking about a judge, for reasons I'll come back to in a bit. But the statement is that a judge, once he's received a payment from a party to a case, he's not going to be able to see guilt in that litigant's side. And then it says, and here's the poetic part, the my shochad, what is the word shochad, which literally means bribe? Shehu chad. It makes them one. I added in the possibility that it means that it is sharp, because chad can also mean sharp, but I think the actual translation is meant to be shehu chad. It takes two parties and makes them one. Same idea as what we talked about in the Law Society's definition in terms of the interest. So, that brings me to our vignette, which produces 3 questions. Source number 3. While attending the same university between 2003 and 2006, Jonathan and Sarah were part of a student Facebook group, occasionally commenting on each other's status updates and uploaded photographs. Jonathan left Facebook in 2006 and has neither seen nor communicated with Sarah since. So the questions are, if a business wishes to retain Jonathan as legal counsel in 2015 for a suit against a business owned by Sarah, does Jonathan face a conflict of interest? That's our opening question, and then 2 questions that result. If this is considered a conflict of interest, what can Jonathan do in order to represent the business? And if this is not a conflict of interest, is Jonathan required to inform the business of his connection to Sarah at all? What would you say regarding the first question that's there? I don't want to address the second and third yet, but in terms of the first question, would the fact that they were associated with the same student group and had some communication back and forth with each other on Facebook in 2003 to 2006, would that affect Jonathan's ability to represent a client who wanted to sue Sarah's business in 2015? No. Why not?
Basically, it's not. There's no business between them. They have no business whatsoever between them.
Okay.
They're not friends as such, close friends. They basically have their relationship with Facebook, which means they're open.
So we've defined that there is no pecuniary interest, right? There's no financial relationship. That's true. And he says Facebook friendship means zero. So not everyone is necessarily going to agree. Right? I mean, those of us who have 672 friends on Facebook may agree.
This doesn't say a friendship. It says they communicated and sometimes wrote each other. So literally close friendship, nothing that would hold out one stronger than the other.
That may sound like more like being classmates. You know, if you say if you had a classmate, you know, if you're in the same law class, does that mean that, you know, there's a conflict of interest? One would think automatically, no, never.
Right. Okay. And does anybody want to argue the other side? There is a side to argue. There is a possibility here, but we'll see it as we go through it. Let's first talk about the philosophy behind this whole issue. And I mentioned before that the Law Society's definition was not fully expansive. The Law Society said that there has to be a genuine, serious risk to the duty of loyalty or to client representation. There has to be a sense that he won't represent or she won't represent the client properly. And the reason for this is seen in source number 4. Source number 4, you see the case reference, McDonald Estate v. Martin. In determining whether a disqualifying conflict of interest exists, the court is concerned with 3 competing values. 1, the concern to maintain the high standards of the legal profession and the integrity of our system of justice. We want people to be represented properly. 2, the countervailing value that a litigant should not be deprived of his or her choice of counsel without good cause. Right? People have the right to pursue representation and to approach somebody. And if you're going to be too restrictive in your definition of conflict of interest, the result is people can't get the lawyer they feel will best represent them. And then number three, the desirability of permitting reasonable mobility in the legal profession. We also want the lawyer to be able to function properly. And this comes up not just in terms of representing this particular client, but the issue of potentially moving from one firm to another firm, and the question of what happens to clients you knew about in the previous firm. Does that affect your ability to function, the ability of other lawyers to function? If you clamp down too hard on conflict of interest, you make it very difficult for lawyers to deal with that sort of a situation. So that's the challenge here. The conflict of interest can really be broken down, though, into two separate challenges. These are the challenges that emerge from having a conflict of interest. If you take a look at source number 5 from the Law Society's Rules of Professional Conduct, the commentary on Rule 3.4-1, 3.4 in general is where conflict of interest is discussed, but the commentary gives us what our concern is in relatively clear English. The value of an independent bar is diminished unless the lawyer is free from conflicts of interest. The rule governing conflicts of interest is founded in the duty of loyalty, which is grounded in the law governing fiduciaries. The lawyer-client relationship is a fiduciary relationship, and as such, the lawyer has a duty of loyalty to the client. To maintain public confidence in the integrity of the legal profession and the administration of justice, in which lawyers play a key role, it is essential that lawyers respect the duty of loyalty. Aspects of the duty of loyalty owed to a current client are the duty to commit to the client's cause, the duty of confidentiality, the duty of candor, and the duty to avoid conflicting interests. Current clients must be assured of the lawyer's undivided loyalty, free from any material impairment of the lawyer and client relationship. So I underline two different points within this paragraph. One, the lawyer has a duty of loyalty to the client. And put very simply and plainly, if I hire somebody, I retain somebody to serve as my legal representation, I have the right to assume that they're going to represent me wholeheartedly and they're not going to cheat any of their duties to me. So for example, if they have information separately, whether it's from my opposition or from whatever, but they're not going to disclose it to me and it affects my case, they violate their duty of candor to me. In the event that their interest elsewhere is going to keep them from representing me fully, they're not going to do the job for me. All sorts of responsibilities that fit under this fiduciary responsibility that are going to keep the lawyer from serving me properly, that's number one. It's direct, it's personal. It's a contractual obligation, effectively, that the lawyer has to me. Then there's a second plane to all of this. And the second plane is what they noted in terms of public confidence in the integrity of the legal profession and the administration of justice. There's an overarching concern, which is our judicial system relying on the ability of clients to trust their lawyers to represent them properly is threatened if lawyers are able to practice while they have a conflict of interest. So there is the personal concern, the relationship between this lawyer and this client, and then there is the separate concern, the overarching concern about the integrity of the legal system. If anyone doesn't have sheets, by the way, there are more on the table in the back. Okay. That's all within the secular system. Jewish law has the same two concerns. But here I have to go back to a point that I made briefly in the beginning, which is, as we've noted on other occasions, where is the lawyer within the Jewish legal system? There is none. There is in practice, but in terms of the institutions that are established biblically and Talmudically, there is no role necessarily for a lawyer. The two litigants go before the court. The judge is on the rabbinical court. They are the jury, effectively. They hear the case, they hear the testimony, and they offer a decision. It is true that going back to Talmudic times, there was a position of oreich din, somebody who would assist somebody in presenting a claim. Toein is a more modern term that's used for it. There were people who would help arrange the case. However, they're not required to be there. There's no official position. It's simply, this is somebody who's going to come help you out so that you can say what you need to say in front of the judges. But as a result of that, we can't really speak directly in terms of conflict of interest law for lawyers. However, both of these concerns, the concern about the obligation that the lawyer has to this particular client and the overarching concern about the legal system, will have applications in a Jewish court of law. And the way it works is to look at two other positions that have these issues outside of the lawyer position. In terms of the challenge of fulfilling one's contractual obligation, making sure that one is going to provide proper service to the client, that exists in every profession. It's not unique to law. Law may be somewhat unique in the sense that the client doesn't really know a whole lot about how things work, and the lawyer could theoretically get away with something without the client knowing it. I hire a painter to come to my house, and the painter does a bad job, I'll know that the painter did a bad job. Maybe. I don't know if I'll know. I'm assuming that. The carpenter, if the chair collapses, then I know the carpenter did a bad job. With the lawyer, the fact that I lose the case doesn't necessarily mean the lawyer did a bad job. There are a whole host of reasons I could lose a case. So this concern, though, does exist in certain other professions. It exists. It exists in all sorts of consulting type of professions, and so we have a rule that, in general, one is not allowed to give advice to somebody else on the basis of personal interest, and not only in a professional relationship, but even in a personal relationship. If somebody asks me for advice, or I even volunteer advice, I am not allowed to give advice that is biased by my personal interest. If you take a look at source number 6, this is a comment from the Midrash going back more than 2,000 years on a biblical verse. The biblical verse they're commenting on is, "V'lifnei iver lo sitein michshol." Do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. So based on that, they say don't give advice to somebody who doesn't know any better. And you get an example in this Midrash in source number 6. Al tomar lo mechores sadecha v'kach lecha chamor. Don't advise somebody, you know, I think it would be a good idea for you to sell your field in order to buy a donkey. Ve'at v'rata okefa lav v'notla mimenu. While you are in the meantime trying to buy his field. Right? You gave him bad advice to serve your own interest. The same thing will be true regarding a lawyer who has a personal interest, and that leads him to give bad advice. This comes up in all sorts of areas of law-related practice. One example is in source number 7, the case of an apotropos. Apotropos is a Greek term which refers to a legal guardian, whether a guardian appointed by the family or a guardian appointed by the rabbinical court, somebody who is in charge of the property of minors, the property of an incapacitated party. So if you take a look at source number 7, you find the following rule in the Code of Jewish Law regarding the concern for self-dealing. The concern that is involved if this apotropos, this guardian, says, you know, I'm in charge of investing the property of the estate. I have a gold mine that I'm interested in purchasing, and I'd like to use the estate to invest in the gold mine. And just like I would be able to go to Michael and say, I would like to invest their money from this estate with Michael, so this is a perfectly good investment. If Michael owned that investment, I would say invest it with him. So what's the difference if I am the owner? So Rabbi Isserlis, writing in source number 7, says, Yesh omim, some say, K'mosha apotropos yachol litnem la'acherim, kach yachol l'kaveh. Some say that indeed a guardian is allowed to do this. He's allowed to take the funds and invest them in his own venture. But he's going to have to make sure the rabbinical court oversees it because of concern for what this looks like, what it's going to cause people to say. And we're going to come back to that concern at the end, the concern for gossip. But the point is, we have this concern, and it's only a some say that he's actually allowed to do this in the first place, oversight or no oversight. We have the concern for conflict of interest in terms of my responsibility to the person who is hiring me. That's on the personal level. But I think we also see it in terms of the challenge to the integrity of the legal system as a whole. We see it regarding judges. The Talmud and its rules are recorded in the Code of Jewish Law, disqualify judges for various conflicting interests, regardless of their personal righteousness. It doesn't make a difference. Now, technically, the judge owes nothing to the litigants. There's no contractual relationship between the judge and the parties. However, the judge owes it to the legal system that the judge represents. And here, we'll take a closer look at how this works. A judge, generally speaking, is disqualified for judging cases as a nogeya badavar. Nogeya badavar means that someone has personal contact with the issue that is under discussion. And we'll see some examples of it soon. But it's not only where it's between two litigants. It's also in other kinds of rabbinical court functions. I brought you an example in source number 8, in a religious area. The Jewish calendar has remarkable accuracy, but it requires a lot of work. When I say accuracy, what I mean is the Jewish calendar is what we call a solar lunar calendar. It is matched up to the solar calendar and to the lunar calendar simultaneously. That's a challenge. It means that certain holidays have to occur in certain seasons of the year, but the months all work with the period of the moon. So how do you coordinate that? It's actually a big challenge because you have 12 months in a normal year, but the period of the sun is going to be 365 days. Not the period of the sun, the period of the earth, really. But the earth takes 365 days to go around the sun. The period of the moon is 29 and a half days. If you multiply 29 and a half by 12, you aren't going to hit 365. So how do you coordinate and make sure that in 12 months you had 365 days go by? So the answer is you have a system in which it's called the Metonic cycle. 7 times in 19 years, you actually add a month to your calendar. Now, today, that's all fixed. There is a set system. Guach Adzat is your mnemonic for those who are interested in that. The 3rd year of the cycle, the 6th year of the cycle, the 8th year of the cycle, the 11th year, 14th year, 17th year, and 19th year of the cycle will all be leap years. But historically, that wasn't the way it was done. Historically, a rabbinical court would convene, and they would decide whether the calendars needed this synchronization. So the question is, who gets to sit on that court? And the Talmud states in source number 8, the king is not eligible to sit on the court, and the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is not eligible to sit on this court. Why are they disqualified? So the king, because of his forces, his army, meaning that the king pays out wages to his soldiers. They're paid by the year. If this year has 13 months, he gets a free month of service on the deal. So therefore, he has an interest in making it a leap year. You follow? He wants to get an extra month of service. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, because the rule is that the priests in the temple in Jerusalem serve barefoot. And the concern is that they get cold. They had a fire that burned to heat the floor. There's a fire in one room, and that was supposed to warm things. But really, how effective is that going to be come October, and it's rainy Jerusalem? So the result of that is that the high priest has an interest in not having a leap year. Because if you have a leap year, that pushes off all the holidays to be later in the solar calendar. He wants the holidays to be earlier. He's really happy when Yom Kippur is going to be September 16th. He's not happy when Yom Kippur is going to be the beginning of October and he has to do all this service while barefoot on a cold floor. So because he has a personal interest, the king has a financial interest. The high priest has a personal interest. Therefore, they're not eligible to sit on the court. But but there's a problem here. And it's a fascinating problem. It's fascinating to me. I hope it's fascinating to you. While we say that, we're going to see that judges are disqualified from handling cases in rabbinical court if they have a personal interest. Not only these sort of esoteric interests, but more direct ones, like a financial interest. A judge is not allowed to hear the case. On the other hand, imagine for a moment that you're a rabbi, and at home, you accidentally put, or somebody in your household accidentally put, a meat spoon into a dairy pot. And now you have to figure out, we're not allowed to mix meat and meat, and what's the status of the spoon and what's the status of the food? Are you allowed to give a ruling on your own on the status of the food, on the status of the spoon? Are you allowed to decide that yourself? Based on our concerns so far for conflict of interest, you shouldn't be able to. I would like to eat dinner. right? I don't want to throw out dinner because the meat and the milk got mixed up. So maybe I should have to call up some other rabbi and ask him to handle the case. But it's not true. The rule is that with most such questions, not all, with most such questions, the judge, the rabbi in this case, is allowed to hear his own questions at home, regardless of any interest involved. And it's not just a rabbi. I mentioned a rabbi because that's convenient, but the truth is that people on their own answer such questions, deal with such issues on a regular basis within their own households. So the question now is, if Jewish law has a concern for conflict of interest, which it does, and again, we're going to see a lot of cases about this coming up, then why is it that when it comes to these aspects of ritual law, you're allowed to answer your own questions, and we're not concerned for conflict of interest? What's the difference between the two?
It affects you. It's not affecting anybody outside.
So?
And you're expected to know these rules anyway. I mean, ideally, you shouldn't have to call the rabbi to ask these questions. Ideally, you should know yourself as a discussion.
Yeah, but you have an interest in answering it the wrong way.
You know, that cuts right through your entire life.
Right, so Michael says it would just be too big a burden. If you're going to require that they run to the rabbi every time, it will be a big burden on the rabbi.
No. You say basically, conflict interest has to be another individual. It cannot be you personally.
So it's not a concern about honesty regarding myself. It's only a concern about the impact on other people.
Right.
Exactly. Okay, that's a reasonable approach.
But that's not the Kohen Gadol. He's in Kohen Gadol's personal interest.
Right, well, the Kohen Gadol's case is his personal interest, but he's going to affect the nation as a whole. He's going to warp their calendar for the sake of keeping his feet warm on Yom Kippur. That's one approach you can take to it. Take a look at source number 9, please, the top of the second side. Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, better known as, what is he known as? Chazon Ish, right. Chazon Ish, a major authority in Jewish law in the middle of the 20th century. Wrote the following. He says, "V'hine ein hazharas hashochad miklal hamishpatim ela miklal hachukim." He says, the truth is, the warning against bribes is not a rational law. It's not something where you can say that there's a logic to it. He says it's simply a chok. A chok is a law you can't understand, because he says, "Shari lo asra haTorah hara le'atzmo, v'adam roa treif la'atzmo." The Torah did not prohibit ruling for oneself. It said if someone slaughters an animal and he's not sure whether it's kosher or not, whether it was done properly, he's able to examine it. Avim hudal v'chol chayav tzluyim bo. Even if he's indigent and his entire life depends on it, and yes, it could even be a case. I didn't give you perhaps a broad enough case. It can be a case in which it impacts somebody else. So he simply says it's chok. The Torah has insight into human nature, and it says this is the law. But I wonder if you couldn't suggest that what's going on here is like the secular system's concern for the integrity of the overarching system of representation and the overarching legal system. In other words, what Jewish law is concerned about is not only the relationship with the client and the issue of are you fulfilling your contractual obligation to the client, it's also concerned with the damage you do to the legal system in the event that there is dishonesty. If it's just a case that's in my own kitchen, the legal system is not involved. It's only once we enter into a case and the public trust that we now have an issue. It's an issue of the public trust, and I'll provide support for my contention. Take a look, please, at source number 10. Democracy in Action, in source number 16. Rabbi Moshe Isserlis, writing in the Ashkenazi portion of the Code of Jewish Law, says the following. If there's a community matter on which they can't find common ground, imagine that. There's some issue within the community, and not everybody agrees. So what you do is you take all the taxpayers and you convene them together. And they agree that everybody should vote. But vote altruistically, he specifies. And you follow the majority. He says, that's the way you do it. You work democratically, he said, back in the 16th century in Poland. And based on that, you have the following very interesting case in source number 11 regarding hiring a rabbi. And the story was, I brought you the text here, but I'll explain it outside. You can see it yourself in source number 11. The people wanted to hire a rabbi. They narrowed it down to four candidates. And then they didn't know what to do. So what they decided was, they're going to take a box and put in strips of paper with the names of the four candidates. They'll pull out one at random, and the people will vote. If there are more yeses than noes, he's the winner. Forget the other three. If there aren't more yeses than noes, then you go to the second one, then the third one, and then the fourth one. That's the way they voted on a rabbi in Hungary in the first half of the 18th century.
This was kept.
Well, watch what happened. They did this. They had a gathering, and they had the vote. First candidate, thumbs down. Second candidate, thumbs down. Third candidate, thumbs up. Okay, we have a rabbi, the white smoke comes out of the chimney, and all is good. Until word starts to get around that a whole bunch of the voters have been bribed by relatives of candidate number three. And so the question comes to Rabbi Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as Chasam Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, major authority in 18th century Hungary. And he gives his opinion on it. And he says, of course this is no good. Not only is their hiring of number three no good, but their rejection of numbers one and two is also no good. You have to start from scratch. Even though the argument could be made, when I heard this in the shiur from Herschel Schachter, he went on to length about this. He said, people hire a rabbi for all sorts of reasons, right? One hires a rabbi because he wants someone with a long beard. One hires the rabbi because he likes his speeches. One hires a rabbi because he's going to be strict. One hires a rabbi because he wants more lenient. So these people hire the rabbi because they wanted him to give them money. So that's why they voted for him. Why is that a better or worse motivation than anything else? But the answer is, it is a terrible motivation because your obligation, as written by Rabbi Moshe Isserlis in source number 10, is to vote l'shem shamayim, to vote altruistically. That's the responsibility. And to me, what I see here is the second problem of conflict of interest. In addition to the contractual issue, you have a retainer from a client that says you're going to represent him. You don't have the right to represent him in an inferior way. There's also the harm to the public trust. There's the harm to the legal system. In this case, it's the issue of hiring a rabbi as opposed to sitting in a court. But it's the same concept. There's a public trust that is betrayed in the event of a conflict of interest. So the upshot of this is that both systems recognize the dangers of conflict of interest on the level of contractual obligation to the client, as well as the damage to the overarching integrity of the system. Clear so far? Okay. We're not going to see, by the way, I was going to say this in the beginning, but I forgot. We're not going to see a whole lot of daylight between the Jewish and secular system here. In some of the sessions we've had, we've actually seen significant daylight in terms of some of the confidentiality issues, in terms of bankruptcy, other topics we've discussed. Here, there are going to be two big differences, but for the most part, down the line, the systems are aligned. So, how do we define conflict of interest? What about Facebook friendship in the case that we gave in the beginning? So in the secular system, the first rule is that there are no rules for defining conflict of interest, meaning that you only have the broadest possible recommendations involved. If you take a look at source number 12, one particular case that I saw, Committee for Justice and Liberty v. National Energy Board, 1978, and this case is quoted by a whole lot of others, the proper test to be applied in a matter of this type was correctly expressed by the Court of Appeal. As already seen by the quotation above earlier in the decision, the apprehension of bias must be a reasonable one, held by reasonable and right-minded persons, applying themselves to the question and obtaining thereon the required information. In the words of the Court of Appeal, that test is, quote, what would an informed person viewing the matter realistically and practically, and having thought the matter through, conclude? We're not going to give you specifics. And if you take a look at source number 13, you see that in the case of, and I'm going to mispronounce it probably, but we wake them Indian Band v. Canada, another case that gets quoted broadly. It cannot be addressed through peremptory rules. And contrary to what was submitted during oral argument, there are no textbook instances. The underlining is my own. Whether the facts as established point to financial or personal interest of the decision maker, present or past link with a party, counsel or judge, earlier participation or knowledge of the litigation, or expression of views and activities, they must be addressed carefully in light of the entire context. There are no shortcuts. You can't define a rule and say, this is the rule we're going to apply, and we'll know yes or no based on this rule. And there's a concern. There's a booklet put out called Ethical Principles for Judges. And in there, they talk about the dangers of being too specific about standards. You know, if you said first cousin is no good, but second cousin is good, you run afoul of the concerns that we expressed in the beginning. Of, on the one hand, limiting people's access to proper legal representation, and limiting the lawyer's ability to function if you're too restrictive. In some cases, the first cousin, they may never even have met. And then on the other hand, if you're going to be too broad and say second cousins are all okay, then you can end up allowing a conflict of interest because sometimes the second cousins are very close. Your rules aren't really going to work very well. Within this system, the broader secular system, there are mitigating factors to be considered as well that may make a conflict of interest less of a conflict. One is where the interest does not directly compete with the case at hand. And I brought you a case that I've seen referenced quite a bit, this case of Canadian National Railway Company v. McKercher. And the case, basically, as I understand it, was a case out in Alberta in which there was a grain farmer representing a whole class who wanted to sue CN Rail, and he sought representation by this firm, McKercher LLP. McKercher represented CN Rail in other issues, completely not related to the case at hand, commercial real estate, other things. And McKercher wanted to be able to represent CN Rail for whatever they were still doing, and to represent this farmer who was representing the class against CN Rail. And what they actually did was they gave up their various legal work that they were doing for CN Rail, except that they wanted to represent them in one commercial issue. CN Rail argued, on the other hand, you were our representatives until now, and surrendering it now is ineffective. They also dropped them for the commercial real estate anyway. That wasn't surprising. But take a look at source number 14, where the court says, as part of the ruling, the rule, meaning this issue of the rule against representing with a conflict of interest, applies where the immediate legal interests of clients are directly adverse. The italics come from the decision. It does not apply to condone tactical abuses. Right, I saw some very interesting tactical abuse questions. I'm sure these are all familiar to you, but they were new to me. Like the idea of, if you're dealing with a case, there are two parties in a case, and one party knows the other one is likely to approach a certain lawyer. So this one calls him up and leaves confidential information on his voicemail in order to disqualify him. That's a bad thing. Don't do that. That was an example of a tactical abuse. And it does not apply in circumstances where it is unreasonable to expect that the lawyer will not concurrently represent adverse parties in unrelated legal matters. Okay? It doesn't apply. The concern for conflict does not apply where it is unreasonable to expect that the lawyer will not, I love double negatives, concurrently represent adverse parties in unrelated legal matters. So, if it's unreasonable to expect this non-competition to occur on an unrelated matter, then the lawyer may indeed represent the other side. That's one limitation. Another is the magnitude of the interest at hand. Just how big a deal is the interest? And here I bring in source number 15, something written for judges, but the principle, I believe, is the same when you're dealing with lawyers. Owning an insurance policy, having a bank account, using a credit card, or owning shares in a corporation through a mutual fund would not, in normal circumstances, give rise to conflict or the appearance of conflict unless the outcome of the proceedings before the judge could substantially affect such holdings. That's the underlines are mine. So number one is a substantial effect. But number two, nor should small holdings, such as those contemplated by the de minimis provisions of ABA Model Code 1990, give rise to any reasonable question concerning the judge's impartiality. However, if the holding is more substantial, the judge should not sit, and so on. In other words, there's a difference between saying, yes, we had a tiny interest, then saying, we had a major issue. Actually, in Rabbi Reese's shiur that I mentioned in the beginning, his lecture on this, he talked about a bizarre thing. I don't know if this is relevant north of the border. How many people here knew about Bush versus Gore on the Supreme Court in 2000? Okay, I don't know. I had almost forgotten about it already. So apparently what happened was there was a letter to the ABA Journal some years later that written by a friend of Judge Rehnquist, who was the Chief Justice on that. He apparently had, and you have to look it up to find the details, but he had a friendship with Judge Rehnquist, and they used to place friendly bets on election results. And so he had in his possession a fax from Judge Rehnquist when it looked like the case was going to go before the Supreme Court, in which he said, I ask you to release me from all bets that were made because this is now going to come before my court to decide who won the election. So realistically, I think that that would come under the banner of small holdings. I thought that was a very interesting case. Another potential mitigating factor is the passage of time, and here I've seen conflicting things. If you take a look at source number 16, you find a ruling that suggests that notwithstanding the passage of some 16 years since the time of the brief solicitor-client relationship that posed the conflict, the lack of recollection of that relationship by both DGC and Sachs J, Judge Sachs, prior to the release of the decision, and the independent concurrence of Judge Frank and myself in the decision authored by Judge Sachs, in my view, prudence dictates that the decision be set aside, even though nobody even remembered this, and even though we think the decision was right, and even though 16 years passed, we still believe that the decision should be set aside. And a new panel in that particular case that's being described there should be struck. On the other hand, the ethical principles for judges suggests that if 2.5 or 3 years or 5 years have gone by, that's already enough time. This goes back to our point. You can't really create a hard and fast rule. So much depends on what it is that was the interest in the first place and the particulars of the case at hand. So from a secular standpoint, we first say there are no hard and fast rules, but there are certain factors that ought to be considered. Is it direct or indirect, this conflict? How big is the interest involved? Has there been a lot of time since the interest actually was an interest? So taking that and applying it to our discussion about the Facebook friends, remember that personal relationships, as outlined in source number 17, are an issue also. Financial relationship, financial interest is not the only one. Personal relationships are indeed an issue. However, when this case has come up, and it has, generally speaking, the sense has been that Facebook friendship does not constitute an interest that would conflict. Just let me just bring you number 18. My review of cases where the issue has been dealt with indicates that while Facebook friendship indicates that the parties know each other, it does not, underline is mine, without more, establish that there is a relationship which would result in a reasonable apprehension of bias according to the accepted test. More evidence is needed. Yes?
Yeah, there's one word that actually solves the problem anyway. The word
close.
Occasionally.
Oh.
And that word occasionally means they're not friends. It said they were all doing it, but occasionally, that changes the entire factor.
Because I wrote occasionally in it, as opposed to regularly. That's an interesting point. Okay, no, that's an interesting point. So here, what we're suggesting is the Facebook friendship is not an indicator. Now, I should note something that I said in the beginning. There's one reason why it might not be so clear, and that's what I want to come back to now. It's important to distinguish between something that actually presents a conflict and something that signals a conflict. Meaning, when you see the Facebook friendship there, you say, okay, now let me investigate. It's a warning sign. If you investigate and that's the sum of their relationship, then good. However, if you investigate and find that they actually were close, this was just a tip-off, then you know that there's something there. So that's something that's important to note, is that it can signal a problem.
I think it depends how old they are.
Yeah?
Past a certain age, it doesn't matter.
Maybe. Okay, so that's all within the secular system. What would we say within Jewish law. So Jewish law recognizes, as we've said, like the secular system, two different kinds of interest: pecuniary, financial, as well as personal. Source number 18 is the verse that I mentioned in the beginning. Vishochad lo sikach, that you shall not take a bribe. Ki ashochad yaver pikrim visalech divrei tzadikim, it will blind the sighted and warp the words of the righteous. And so the code of Jewish law rules in source number 20. Rabbi Yosef Karo, the original author of the code of Jewish law, writes, wherever a judge has potential benefit, he may not judge the case. So much so that take a look at source number 20. Source number 20 comes from, I'm sorry, number 21, comes from one of the main Talmudic passages dealing with concern for conflict of interest. We're going to quote it extensively later on. But source number 21, we are told the following. Vishochad lo sikach. They quote the biblical text that said, you shall not accept a bribe. Ma talmud lomar. What does that teach me? Im lalame shlo lezako says achayev, shlo lechayev es hazakayev. It's just to teach me that you're not supposed to get it wrong. Right? Don't take a bribe in order to harm the innocent or in order to exonerate the guilty. Remember, they're talking about judges, not lawyers. They're in a position of deciding something. But if you're telling me that it's a bribe in order to give the wrong decision, the law says, the Torah says, you shall not warp justice. So I didn't need a warning about bribery. It's an overarching warning. Never get it wrong. What's the point of a warning about bribery? So the Talmud says, Ela filu lezakos es hazakai ulechayev es achayev. Even if he says, I am giving you this money to get it right, I would like you to make sure that you judge this case carefully. And if I lose the case, them's the breaks. I lose the case. If one of the litigants gives you money and says, this is an incentive for you to judge this case properly, and he's not being cynical, he's not being, you know, there's no wink involved when he says that. Nonetheless, Amra Torah, Vishochad lo sikach, you shall not accept a bribe. It doesn't make a difference. You will still be affected, and therefore you can't do it. That's on the financial side of things. Yes, John.
Sorry, I'm
rejecting,
but you skipped past 17.
No, I'm sorry. Because 17 was just to show that in the secular system, it's not just about financial interest; it's also about personal interest.
Right.
Right, so what I've seen in the literature seems to indicate that one should not be acting on their behalf.
Depends on the situation.
So you'd have to give me more specifics. I didn't see an exception to it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But
family law situations, it's definitely found.
Yeah.
But not necessarily other, say, real estate or other situations.
Interesting. I suspect that it may involve, what you're describing may involve consent.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying it's depends on the situation.
Right. So I'm going to come back to that a little bit in the consent discussion. I think I know what you're referring to. But in terms of the financial interest, it's very clear that we have a concern, but it's not only about financial interest. It's also about personal interest. If you take a look at source number 22, Asur la'adam lidon lemishu ohavo. One is not allowed to judge a case involving one's friend. Even though he's not his shushvin or his closest friend, a shushvin historically was actually a legal friendship relationship in which people would go to each other's weddings and provide gifts for each other, and then they were legally bound to provide it for each other within the circle. In other words, I go to your wedding, you go to my wedding, and it's actually it wasn't written down. It was just short of contractual, but that was the idea of a shushvin relationship. So he says, even if this friend doesn't meet that standard, nonetheless, you can't judge his case. Velola Misha Sona'o, nor may you judge a case for someone who's your enemy. Even though he's not a real enemy, he's not trying to hurt him. The two litigants have to be equal in the eyes of the judges. Now again, we're coming from a judge perspective, not a lawyer perspective. But the point is to show the recognition of conflict of interest, not only where there's a financial issue, but also where there is a personal issue. Interestingly, one is allowed to testify against or in favor of a friend or an enemy. Why would we allow testimony if we don't allow judging? Why would we allow you to testify? Yeah?
Well, testifying basically means all you're saying is giving evidence. It's up to the judge to decide.
Right. So, well, leaving out the last point about being up to the judge, this is discussed in 23:24. In 24, Rabbi Yehoshua Falk offers the following justification. He says, in testimony, you're just giving evidence. As you said, you're reporting on what you saw. And we don't think that people are going to actively warp their testimony. That's not our concern. Our concern is bias in terms of your analysis. So if you're going to judge, then bias may come into play. I frankly wonder about that because there can be bias also in my memory of what I saw.
Absolutely.
Right. The judge decides
credibility.
So therefore, it doesn't matter what you say, the judge makes upon the decision.
We don't like to allow in, though, something that we suspect could be wrong.
There's a necessity aspect to it, though, because you can't necessarily choose your witnesses. It's not like you can go out and choose, you know,
right.
There might be a limited set of people who saw it, and to say, and to disqualify people, you need to be a higher standard.
That's a really interesting point. If you heard what he said, if you're going to disqualify witnesses on the basis of friendship or enmity, recognizing that it's not as though he has a choice of who he's going to have as his witness to a particular event that took place, you could potentially end up destroying the possibility of him having a fair trial because you've now killed the witnesses. Whereas with judges, see, you get a recusal from this one, you go to some other court, whatever it is, but here you don't have that option. Yeah.
I think Crown a lot of times uses drug dealers, use other people, which are, you would say, it would apply the same thing in this.
Right.
You're using the worst of drug society at times in a criminal trial. That's the only way to get it. So it really doesn't matter what they're calling it.
Except that they do end up calling into question their credibility.
Oh, it's credibility. Yeah. It could be the same with this witness.
Yeah. Yeah. On the opposite end, you're bringing character witnesses that are usually good friends.
Right. Right. Character witnesses tend to be friends and associates and so on. That's true. Jeffrey.
What witnesses do you have cross-examination of the witnesses? You don't have cross-examination of the judge.
Right. Right. It's a good point. That could be another reason why. Good. So far it sounds like we have identical systems, but here is where we get one of our two divergences between the secular and Jewish systems. If you take a look at source number 25, 23 was the statement that they are allowed to be witnesses, 24 was one justification for it, but let's take a look at 25. This takes us back to that passage in Ketuvot that we saw in source number 21, and gives us three examples. They actually have more there. I only brought three because I wanted to fit everything on two pages, so I stopped there. But they bring more examples of concern for personal interest, and what they call shochad devarim, a verbal bribe. What is a verbal bribe? And they give you three cases. Shmuel was crossing a river. Someone gave him a hand. Unclear with Mavra whether it means that he was crossing some kind of a bridge or on a ferry. It doesn't matter for our purposes. But someone came and extended his hand to help him across. He said, oh, what brings you here? He said, I have litigation. Guess what? He said, I can't judge your case because you gave me a hand in crossing the river. Second case, a sage named Amemar. He is judging a case. And a feather falls on his head. Asahu gavra shakle. So someone comes along and takes the feather off of his head. Amalei maya viditach. He said, what brings you here? What are you doing here? Amalei dina isli. I have litigation. Amalei basil nalach ladina. He says, I can't judge your case. And then a third case, very similar. Marukva habashadi roka kamei. Marukva, another of the sages, had spat in front of himself on the ground. Asahu gavra kastye. Someone came along and covered it up. You know, so it should look respectful. You know, this puddle there. So amalei maya viditach. So again, he says, what are you doing here? Dina Isli, I have litigation on my life. And he said, I am disqualified. I can't judge for you. The next case they bring is a case involving one of the sages, Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi, who had a sharecropper who used to bring him some of the produce as he was required contractually to do every Friday. 1 week, the fellow brings him the basket on Thursday. He says, oh, why'd you bring it on Thursday? He said, well, I had litigation anyway, so I figured let me bring it earlier rather than show up twice. He said, that's great, but I'm disqualified to judge for you. Even though the sharecropper was bringing him that which was his due, he just brought it a day earlier. Nonetheless, they're not willing to hear the case. I think it's fairly clear that the cases we're describing here will not meet the standard for conflict of interest in under the rules of law society or the Canadian Bar Association. These are what we call midat chasidut, traits of piety. For someone to be pious and say, I am not going to, I'm not going to hear the case, I'd rather avoid hearing the case. I should note that when you deal with judges, there actually is a higher standard before the case than there is once they've already heard it and given their decision. Meaning, if they know about a lesser conflict beforehand, it is recommended that they recuse themselves, even if, had they ruled, and it had come to light after the fact, we wouldn't have been bothered by the interest. Because there is the concern still about it, and we say, lechatchila, initially, you should avoid it.
Anyway, in that last example, though, he doesn't clarify whether he's recusing himself because he brought the product to the early or because we already have that financial relationship. It could be, had he shown up without it early, he might have said, I still can't judge.
So from the context, it appears not. It appears he did not consider this relationship to be a problem for him to hear the case. It's a good point. Zevi makes the point that in the case I just mentioned, the one that's not on your sheet, the case with the sharecropper, right? He wasn't disqualifying himself just because this fellow has a business involvement with him. Right? No, let's say he showed up on the right day. He showed up on the right day with a basket, or he didn't bring a basket on Thursday. Would he have been willing to hear the case? It sounds like he would have. I wonder about that a little bit also. It's a good point. I'm just going to go a little further because we said an hour and a quarter, and I'm going to try to stick very closely to that. But what about the fact that the Facebook friendship was years ago, right? Is there a possibility within the Jewish system of saying the interest was a long time ago? So take a look, please, at source number 26. Umeidin zelazed. The rule is that two people who are business partners are allowed to testify for each other. And the Talmud asks, Amai, why? Nogin beidu sanein, they have an interest in their testimony. To which they answer, no, this is where they actually first write a quick claim. They say, we have no claim on this. Whatever it was, the field that they own together, we deny any claim, we're now separating, and therefore we're okay. So writing on that, Tosfot, rabbinical commentary to the Talmud in 12th century France for this particular one, in source number 27, asks the question. That means that initially, when they actually witnessed the event, they were connected to each other. They were partners. How is it that they are able to do this quick claim, and then now they're going to be eligible to testify? Tosfot asks, don't we require that they should be credible from beginning to end? They should be acceptable from beginning to end. And so the rabbinic authority there in source number 27 answers, it depends on the type of disqualification. If the disqualification is of one's person, you're their brother, you're their brother-in-law, then if you're disqualified that way at any point in the case, that's it. You can't testify. However, if it's because of a personal financial interest, then if you get rid of the financial interest, you are able to testify. We make that distinction, which is really part of a broader discussion that I don't want to go into, but I wanted to show you this because the Facebook friendship is more like the pecuniary interest. It's more like the financial interest, which is to say, once it's gone, if you can demonstrate that it's gone, it's not going to be an issue anymore. The fact that I was friends with them umpteen years ago, even if the original event occurred that I'm going to bear witness to, was when we were still friends. If now we're not, that will be good enough to clear me from it. Again, this is a witness discussion. This is not a lawyer discussion. But the idea of passage of time, I think, may well be relevant. Jeffrey.
Yeah, but before we also learned that a friend or an enemy can testify,
Right.
So that would...
Right, no, I'm applying it here to this. The friend is allowed... I'm sorry, I should have made myself more clear. I rushed a little bit too much. The friend is able to testify. The friend cannot serve as a judge. What I'm bringing here is to talk about passage of time in a financial case. I'm borrowing the passage of time element of the financial case here and the personal interest from the judge case there.
Right, but here we're talking about friendship between Jonathan and Sarah, and we know witnesses. Friends can testify.
Right, but you're dealing with a lawyer case. Let me unpack this a little bit. I believe that the rules for what a lawyer can do, and for the paralegals over there as well, I believe that the rules for what a lawyer can do are closer to what the judge does than what the witness does. Because the witness is simply reporting evidence, it's going to be cross-examined, the judge is going to have the opportunity to hear it, and so on. The lawyer case is not like that. In the lawyer case, In the lawyer case, I believe you apply the standard of a judge and say that just like the judge would be disqualified, the lawyer is going to be disqualified as well.
That's using the example here of the two partners testifying. You have a business interest.
Correct.
Are you looking at the business again, not judges or
lawyers? Right, but the principle of does an interest expire with the passage of time is going to be consistent. Yeah, that would be the idea. There's actually a whole other piece to this, which I'm going to hold for now, because it's not directly germane, but it's a discussion about whether there can be conflict of interest for a future interest. So if people want to stick around at the end, I'll take a couple of minutes then to discuss that, but it's not directly relevant, so I'm going to hold it. That's what's in sources number 28 and 29. But the summary of what we've said right now is both systems recognize a conflict of interest issue for both financial and personal interests. The secular precedent would seem to say that Facebook association alone is not significant. The Jewish standard on this seems to be a higher standard and may have an issue with Facebook, at least lechatchila initially, to say better for you to stay away, maybe. But now I want to move to the second issue, which is the possibility of consent. If we say that this is a conflict of interest, is the case closed, or is there something that Jonathan can do to be able to represent the firm that wants to represent the business that wants to sue Sarah's business? So the answer is yes, there is something he can do. It's called consent. Source number 30 from the Rules of Professional Conduct. A lawyer shall not represent a client in a matter when there is a conflict of interest unless there is express or implied consent from all clients, and it is reasonable for the lawyer to conclude that he or she is able to represent each client without having a material adverse effect upon the representation of or loyalty to the other client. Express consent must be fully informed and voluntary after disclosure. Then they go into a discussion of implied consent, but that's a very rare phenomenon, and I'm not going to end up discussing it here. But there is the possibility of the client saying, I understand, and I consent to the representation, and I think that's what you're talking about, John, when you mentioned the possibility of representing a family member. However, there's a very strong limitation on this in source number 31, commentary to that rule. Rule 3.4-2 permits a client to accept the risk of material impairment of representation or loyalty. However, the lawyer would be unable to act where it is reasonable to conclude the representation or loyalty will be materially impaired, even with client consent. Possible material impairment may be waived, but actual material impairment cannot be waived. If the lawyer says, I can't do this, I can't represent properly without being biased, then the lawyer has a responsibility not to accept it, even if the client says, I understand and I accept it. And this is a case in which secular law has a higher standard, I believe, than what Jewish law will apply. In Jewish law, it is the right of the litigant to say, I'm good, I accept, even though, remember, we're not dealing with lawyers now, we'll be dealing with judges, even though this judge is the father of the opposing litigant, he's still able to say, I accept this person as my judge, and that's fine. Source number 32. From the Code of Jewish Law, Misha kibel alav karovo pasul. If someone accepts a relative or disqualified party as is to serve, ben lioso dayan, ben lioso eid alav, whether to be a judge, whether to be a witness, im kanu miado al zeh eino yachol lachzer bo. If there was a kinyan, which is a formal act demonstrating agreement, he cannot recant. He's accepted him, and that's it. So it appears that the that within Jewish law, there is indeed this possibility of accepting him regardless. Now, why the distinction? So I think within secular law, I would have loved to open this up for conversation, but I want to make sure to get to all of the pieces here. I think within secular law, the reason why there's a limitation on consent is because even if the client is able to say, I forgo my right, your personal contractual obligation to me, nonetheless, there is the public trust element of the legal system, which will still be offended. Within the Jewish law system, though, apparently that's okay. Well, first of all, it's not lifnei iver. The concern for giving bad advice to the client, because the client isn't blind. The client knows exactly what's involved, or the litigant knows exactly what is involved. So he's not blind. He's aware. He's walking in with his eyes open. What about the concern about the public trust? So maybe the answer is that once you accept such a person to serve as a judge on your case, you have already acknowledged you're not dealing with what we call in Hebrew mishpat, with justice anymore. This is now some kind of arbitration panel that you're working with, and therefore we're not concerned about an offense to the public trust. Everybody knows this isn't a normal case anymore. But that seems to be the understanding, that as long as they agree to it, they're good. I'm going to jump to the third case just quickly, and then I'll stick around and answer questions to whatever extent people are willing to suffer. But the third question, if it's not a conflict of interest, but there is an appearance of conflict, is the lawyer required to decline? So in the secular system, we've already seen the importance of public confidence mentioned. So yes, the system should require disclosure. It's even more of an issue for judges. I brought you in source number 33. It has also been held that in order to maintain public confidence in the administration of justice, the appearance of judicial impartiality is as important as the reality. And they go on to give you quotes and cases involving that. So in the secular system, there absolutely is fear of that, even more so with judges than with lawyers. But with lawyers as well, we say that. What about within Jewish law? So we've already seen reference to it. We talked about it in terms of the case of a legal guardian who wants to invest the assets of the incapacitated party in his personal venture. And we said we would require, even if we're going to allow it, we'll require rabbinical court oversight because of what people are going to say about it. And the source for this is in source number 34. Source number 34 deals with an issue of conversion. What happens if there is a man who was suspected of, and there was some kind of substantive case, it isn't just random suspicion, but there was some kind of suspicion that he was involved with somebody who was not Jewish. She then converted to Judaism. Is he allowed to now marry her? Or do we have to be concerned? So the Talmud says, well, first of all, the conversion is a valid conversion. There's no question about the validity of the conversion. So the Talmud says, though, he's not supposed to marry her. So they ask, well, if it's a valid conversion, then why can't he marry her? What's wrong? And their answer is, because it's going to cause all sorts of gossip about why she converted, what was involved beforehand, and wrongdoings they would have been involved with. And this is a principle with very broad applications within Judaism about concern for lezus sfasayim, for gossip. We're not supposed to do things that are going to cause people to question. And therefore, just like within the secular system there was a concern for appearances, so too within the Jewish system there was concern for appearances. So to summarize what we've said, and again, if you have to leave, make sure you signed in on the sheets. There are three sheets around on various tables. Number one, both systems are concerned for conflict of interest as a threat to fulfilling your contractual obligation to the client, as well as a threat to the integrity of the overall legal system. Number two, both systems are concerned about financial interests and personal interests, although they recognize that passage of time may reduce the concern for that interest. Whereas within the secular system, there is a limit, and we say only if it's a great interest, something of significance, that's when it matters. Within the Jewish system, we seem to go further and say even minimal personal interest would be a problem. Both systems accept the idea of consent, But the secular system says that consent is only allowed in situations in which the lawyer knows that she can operate without concern for bias, whereas the Jewish law system seems to allow consent in all cases. And finally, both systems are concerned about the appearance of conflict, even when there is no actual conflict. Okay, thank you very much. And one thing before I take questions on it, just to let you know, there is a Midrashet Yom Rishon, a women's learning program that's starting at 10 and running until 11:20. You can walk in the middle if you like, because the second session starts at 10:40. So for sure you can walk in the middle if you like. That's going on in the Rebbetzin Taub Hall right next door. Questions, comments? Yes. Yeah.
I don't know what this Gemara is saying about the conversion, but the conversion laws are that if you find that the woman or man converted for a purpose of getting married, it's not a conversion, because they had no interest in the conversion.
So in terms of the conversion item in that last source, I had a feeling I was going to get in trouble with that one. But in terms of the conversion item, assuming that, and it's a big assumption, but assuming that they accepted sincerely that they're going to practice the mitzvot, even if they had in mind they wanted to marry somebody, after the fact that's a valid conversion. We wouldn't necessarily want to enter into that initially, but after the fact that is 100% valid as a conversion. Yeah.
Second thing.
Yeah.
Based on what you mentioned, this Gemara, concerning the different Rabbanim that basically with the giving of the produce and everything else, they excuse themselves for litigation. At this time, there's probably not one Besdin that exists that can actually sit, because either the member of a shul, his relative is a member. I don't see any Besdin that exists that can exist.
So someone asked me this question. Realistically, how will somebody go to a rabbinical court if you're going to maintain this sort of standard? Our communities are small. So the truth is that in an ideal situation, what you would have is judges whose communal role is limited to serving on the rabbinical court.
Where is that?
So actually,
there's one Besdin in Muncie. It's the only Besdin I know that exists in Canada, the United States, that is totally separate. They have nothing to do with shuls. They have nothing. Any other Besdin has to do with shuls.
So I'm not sure that that's true. I'm not enough of an expert in the rabbinical court system to say that for sure. But I don't want to comment about specific ones on camera. But I believe that there are some that exist in which the rabbis do not, in fact, do not have that. Or what you have in certain cases, for example, the Rabbinical Council of America has a court called the Beth Din of America, and they have many judges who they can call on. And so they may, you know, this judge may have to recuse himself, but there may be others who can step in and sit on the panel.
They're not recusing themselves.
Sorry?
They're not recusing. I'm quite familiar with Beth in America,
Yeah. And
they actually don't recuse themselves. There's always issues of conflict.
Okay, so I'm definitely not taking this one on camera. Next. Sevi.
The Jewish issue of consent, where you could say, I know you're the father of my opponent, that's okay. Isn't that in itself a verbal bribe? You're so honest that it's okay. I know you're my father.
That's really interesting.
So can you say, well, I can't.
Zevi asks, doesn't the act of accepting him as a judge itself present the conflict? So I actually would point out that the argument is usually presented the opposite way. I read a lot of material on judges and conflicts, and the concern is the other way around. When the judge feels this isn't really a conflict and says to the litigants, I want to disclose to you that I have the following relationship to the case, but I don't feel it's good. If the litigant says, I don't agree, the litigant is put in a very bad position by saying that, by having rejected the statement of the judge that I can be honest. He's in a bad spot. So there's actually a lot of discussion surrounding that. You're arguing the opposite, that by saying you accept the judge, now you're actually giving the judge a bribe. It's an interesting question. I think realistically, you're not saying I accept that he can be honest, but I accept that he's a good judge. In other words, you can't tell me that you're going to hear a case involving your own son and not be biased. Is it still, by accepting him, are you saying that you respect his qualities as a judge? Maybe, but in any case, when you go before a judge, you're saying that. So I'm not sure that that's such an issue. Yeah.
I just had a comment on the same point. which is, it's really, it seems to me that it would be open to question here when it says one who accepts a relative or disqualified party as a judge or witness in those akin, he can't recant. The question would be is, to what extent did he, how much was he accepting upon himself? Was he accepting, okay, despite the fact that there's a relationship here, I accept the fact that this guy's going to make a good faith effort to judge the case fairly, or is he just being, giving up his interests essentially, and is he saying, I know he's going to judge, you know, this, I know exactly what he's going to say, and I don't care, he's my father-in-law and I don't really care, you know, I'm just going to give in to it in this case, because I'm just going to let him have his way.
Right. So that's always a concern. That's always a concern way beyond this particular situation. In many agreements, the question is, how sincere were they, and so on. And that's why there's a requirement of kinyan. When you perform an act of kinyan, this act of demonstrating that you're serious about it, there's no challenge that can be mounted afterwards. That is a statement of, this is it, and I accept it. Short of, there is a possibility of writing what's called a moda'a, in which one declares, I'm doing this because I was coerced, but you should know I have a problem with what I'm entering into, and therefore I wanted to submit this document to an independent party before I go ahead with this. But short of that, the act of kinyan demonstrates seriousness. We have that in various areas. If you're familiar with the laws of asmachta, where a person agrees to something in a contract which is so clearly seems to be an exaggeration, and an unrealistic exaggeration, so that normally we would throw it out. He says, if I don't pay you back by this date, this loan of $1,000, I'm going to give you $1,000,000. So we know that he clearly was doing it just as a statement of how serious he is, not as a formal obligation. If he accepts kinyan, if he performs an act demonstrating that he is serious, then he's stuck with that. And if he doesn't pay on time, he owes $1,000,000 as a fine. That's the way it works. So that's what, you're right, there are always going to be such considerations, but the act of kinyan says, I'm taking this seriously anyway. So, yeah, Michael.
This is not necessarily a legal question, but why would the Chazon Ish say, Shechet Altika is a chok? I mean, it strikes me as falling into those, you know, common sense category.
Well,
I mean, what's the not to understand?
Right.
I mean, the limits might not be clear, you know, what's serious, what's not, but conflict of interest certainly.
Right, so Michael asked us about the quote that we had before from Rabbi Karelitz, in which he said that the laws against accepting a bribe are fundamentally chok. They're not rational law. They're not simply, you know, the obvious, so to speak. And the explanation that I understand and what he says is that it's because the parameters don't fit rational parameters. The rational parameter would be, if you have a financial interest, you shouldn't be able to handle the case. And here what we're saying is, even if I do have a financial interest, I just slaughtered my animal. In the event that the shechita, the slaughter, was no good, I am out to the cost of this cow. And yet I'm allowed to rule on it as long as it's for myself. So it's true that a rational argument was presented. Maybe the difference is whether it affects other people or not. But Chazon Ish is saying that demonstrates that, in fact, it is not rational, even though it sure sounds like it. He has a lot of discussion about this in his work, Emuno Bitachon. There's a lot more to say from him about this, but that's what he says.
The Torah itself says, the Torah itself says, because. So.
Yeah, but his argument is the definition of where the because applies is what's not necessarily obvious to the rational mind. You're right, the Torah gives the reason, but it doesn't necessarily give the application of it is not what fits the rational definition. I mean, he's swimming against the tide on this, meaning most people look at a prohibition against bribery and say, well, that's obvious common sense. He knows he's swimming against the tide by saying it, but he's trying to make a point. What he's really out to say when he says it's not rational is, don't convince yourself that you can overcome the influence of a bribe in a particular case. It's not a rational law. Don't think that you can apply reason, except that it's an across-the-board rule. That's really what he's trying to get at when he says that. Okay, for anyone who wants to stick around, I'll discuss the future interest case now, and if you have to go, I'm fine with that. If you go back to source 28, it'll take 5 minutes. The source number 28 is a passage in the Talmud regarding conflict of interest. If you sell a field to somebody else, okay, and it's without accepting responsibility to replace it, meaning the following case. I own a field. Normally, if I sell a field to somebody else, and then my creditors come along and say there isn't enough in my current estate to pay the debts, and they want to claim it from the person who bought the field off of me, they have the rights to do it. That's called achrayus. The property that I have is encumbered to the debt. However, it is possible they're able to claim that for sure. What happens if they claim it from that party who bought it off of me? So I'm going to give a case to make this easier, okay? I had a field. I sold the field to Zevi. Michael is my creditor. Michael comes and takes the field off of Zevi to pay the debt that I owed him. I now have a responsibility to Zevi to make Zevi whole. I have to refund the money to Zevi. However, it is possible that Zevi and I could enter into an arrangement in which I say to Zevi, listen, I want to sell you this field. I don't want to be responsible if anything happens to it. And I don't want to be responsible if anything happens to the field. So I'm going to sell it to you cheap. And if something happens, if somebody claims it, so what? That's the way it goes. Right? That's the case at hand. I'm going to sell the field to Zevi, and Zevi agrees. That's called Shalom Bachrayus. In the event that I sell the field to Zevi under those terms, Ein Meid Lo Aleha. So at that point, I am no longer able to testify when Zevi is holding the field. If some other party comes along, Jeffrey comes along and says, I want to challenge Zevi's ownership of the field, I am not eligible to testify about Zevi's ownership of the field. Why am I not able to testify? Because it is in my interests for Zevi to hold on to the field. Why do I want Zevi to hold the field? So that if Michael comes along later and claims it, Zevi's going to turn it over to him. Are we clear on the case at hand? I have sold Zevi a field. I got money for the field from Zevi, right? Because I want Zevi to be able to turn that field over to Michael later. And so if Jeffrey comes along and he challenges Zevi's ownership of the field, it's in my interest to testify that Jeffrey doesn't know what he's talking about and the field belongs to Zevi, because as long as Zevi is holding it, I can use it to chase my creditor away. You got it? That's the core case at hand in source number 28. So the Talmud asks, but wait a minute, I don't have an interest in it. Because if I have other land that could be used to pay Michael, such that you're going to say, well, I'm trying to protect my other land, that won't work because Michael's going to come after my land first before he ever goes to Zevi. So that doesn't make any sense. And if I don't have any other land anyway, then who cares whether Michael can claim Zevi's field? It doesn't make a difference. He's not getting anything from me regardless. I don't have the means to pay him. Either way, no matter what you do, I have nothing to gain or lose by Zevi holding on to the field. That's the Talmud's question. To which their answer is, I do have an interest. The interest is, I don't want to be a bad person. If Michael wants to claim the money that I owe him, and I don't pay him, then I am a wicked person. Lo ve rasha ve lo yishalem. A wicked person borrows and doesn't pay back. So, therefore, it is in my interest. That's the case brought in the Talmud. I can't testify that Zevi has this field in order to make sure that he's going to use it to pay back Michael. The Talmud asks a question. What do you mean? There's another interest that I have in this case. The interest is, maybe in the future I'm going to come into money. Right? Maybe in the future I will have money and I will have the means of paying back, and therefore it's in my interest now to make sure that he's going to get the field from Zevi as opposed to when I win the lottery in the future and he's going to take the money from me. So why didn't the Talmud entertain that as an interest? And so Tosfot writes in source number 29, the answer is that's a future interest. We don't worry that you are going to be dishonest now because of a potential interest down the line. That's the idea. Or to make it, you know, to try to bring it somewhat into a less complicated case. You have a daughter, and your daughter is in school with a young man who you've had your eyes on forever. And you're thinking that maybe down the line they're gonna be interested. Do you have an interest in making sure that he is protected from whatever it is? So Tosfos is saying, based on this passage in the Talmud, future interests are not going to cause somebody to be dishonest now. That's the principle. So I didn't want to spend time in the actual context of the class itself. It's a rare enough case. But I thought that was an interesting question to be addressed. Thank you very much.